It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
Good evening. Welcome to Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan, our engineer, is here, and Tammy's here to man the phones and the computers. The last bastion of the drug warriors, their last refuge and domain, is a phrase that without which they would be totally defenseless. And what is that phrase? What about the children? Indeed, what about the children? This is a phrase that makes possible the whole drug war. What about the children? Well, in a few moments, we'll bring in our main guest for the night, Debbie Jeffries, whose 8-year-old son uses medical marijuana and is thriving more than ever before. What about the children? Well, first up, here's the first news report from a rookie reporter here on Cultural Baggage.
This story from the Washington Times. The seizure of a North Korean ship suspected of smuggling a huge cache of heroin into Australia last month has increased U.S. fears. Pyongyang is using drug and other illegal trade to finance its nuclear weapons program, a senior Pentagon official told Congress yesterday. The capture of Pongsu on April 20th by Australian security forces heightens the concerns that the North Korean officials may be using illicit trading activities to provide much-needed hard currency to fund its army and weapons of mass destruction programs. And here's what Buford Terrell, professor at South Texas College of Law, had to say. The real point is that the ship was not full of aspirin or even Viagra. Criminals go where the money is, and the money is in the black market. Terrorism is the price of prohibition. From the Baltimore Sun, Governor Elric of Maryland signed a bill reducing penalties for the use of marijuana for medical purposes. The law does not legalize marijuana, but reduces the fine to a maximum of $100 with no jail time. Defendants, however, must convince a judge that they need marijuana for medical purposes. Previously, possession or use of marijuana brought penalties of up to a year in prison or $1,000 fine. From the Daily Telegraph in Great Britain, one of Scotland Yard's most senior officers has called for hard drugs, including crack cocaine and heroin, to be decriminalized, saying that police cannot win the war against dealers. Chief Superintendent Anthony Wills, the borough commander of Hammerstein and Fulham in London, said that as the state cannot control the criminal trade in drugs, it should take it over instead. Quote, "I would have no problem with decriminalizing drugs, full stop," said Mr. Wills. "There will have to be very stringent measures over the production and supply of drugs, and we have got to remove the drug market from criminals. I do not want people to take drugs, but if they are going to, I want them to take them safely, with a degree of purity, and in a controlled way." End quote. Reporting the unvarnished truth for Cultural Baggage, this is Charles Becker.
I want to thank you, Charlie. That's my 20-year-old son, Charlie, and, you know, I'm kind of doing a mea culpa today, you know, in that Debbie Jeffries, the mother of this 8-year-old boy, has never done medical marijuana, and it's beneficial for her son, and we've got kind of the reverse situation here. My son has never smoked pot, and yet for me at times it serves as a welcome medicinal purpose. And I wanted to ask Charlie, what do you feel that marijuana can be effective? Do you think it's a decent medicine?
Most definitely. I mean, I've you know, seen the results that it's had in you, you know, since you had the motorcycle accident with the pinched nerve in your neck, and it's just got so many other things, you know, helping people actually be able to eat whenever they don't have, you know, an appetite, as with it, as AIDS patients do. And it's just, you know, it's a very helpful medicine for people with no appetites, and it's great.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. Debbie, I we'll get to you here in just a moment. I got one more thing I wanted to say. I want to warn Debbie that tonight, I'm also asking the listeners to please respond to a question. And we'll also get a response to this question tonight from a couple of other fellows, Joe McNamara, the former police chief of San Jose, California, and from Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Organization. And I want to hear from you folks at DrugSense. Please, send us your thoughts on this. And the question, is the U.S. government policy on the drug war really just a continuing criminal enterprise? And now, let's go ahead and bring in Debbie Jeffries. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, Dean.
Good evening. How are you tonight?
Great. How are you?
I'm well. I'm much enthused after finally finishing up your book this afternoon. And I want to tell you, it's a wonderful, wonderful read.
Thank you.
You have a lot of information here, quite useful for many people, not just the personal history of your family and of the situation and how it finally resolved with your son, but you have, hints on how to make a proper medical marijuana butter, I guess, and how to learn more information, many links to other organizations and so forth, and a discussion about medicines that really astounded me, the lexicon or the litany of medicines your son had to take.
Absolutely.
Please tell us about the beginnings of this story. You know, for folks who don't know, tell them who you are and about your son.
Okay, well, again, my name is Debbie Jeffries, and my son Jeffrey was diagnosed with mental illness from the time he was 9 months old. And when he was about two, they started him on Ritalin because he had ADHD and obsessive compulsive disorder. And from there, the barrage of medications came and, you know, different diagnoses. And Jeffrey's been very violent, you know, again, since he was 9 months old. And every medication, there was no medication that ever helped him. And it continued to get, you know, it was so out of control. It wasn't just medication that we tried. We tried different therapeutic, if it wasn't parenting classes or therapy or psychiatrists, you know, I did everything I could from different, eliminating red meat or red food colorings or any type of diet to help control Jeffrey, and nothing worked.
No, I'm just going to say that in reading your book, I see you tried every available, you know, opportunity, every organization that you could find for advice, for, some of the doctors gave such terrible advice that it almost killed your son at one point, right?
Absolutely. In fact, at one point, he was on five different medications, and the doctor, Jeffrey, was still out of control, but he was also... he was so limited. He was, you know, almost, he was in a slobbering state in a ball. And the doctor wanted us to take him to the psychiatric hospital and give him one more dose of medication to get him there, just to keep him, you know, under control. And they said, had we done that, it would have killed him because he was at such a toxicity. And his blood pressure was so out of control that, you know, he would have died.
So. And meanwhile, we have a federal government that's prosecuting people like Ed Rosenthal, others who, Valerie Corral and the crew at Wham, that work so hard to help people that are in these, that are in need of this particular types of medicine. And if you would, talk about the situation that when they busted the Wham Club, they took away the mix, I guess, of a blend, if you will, of marijuana that was more beneficial than most anything you could find for Jeff. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. In September, when the DEA came in and raided Wham, Jeffrey's medication that, you know, was taken away, and he spiraled downhill immediately, and, you know, he was without his medication for 3 months. And in December, it was so bad that we thought he was going to have, you know, that we were going to have to give him up to a mental ward. He was so violent and out of control again. It is so sad that the DEA does not recognize this as a medicine.
Yes, I think there's, you know, how to put it, it's not inequity, it's hypocrisy. There's no other word for it that... in lieu of the fact that you may have met some of these folks out there in California that at the normal convention that get 300 joints a month from the federal government,
right,
have been part of an ongoing, you know, 20-year study that has proven to be effective, and yet they can dare to say it has no medicinal value when they arrest people like Mr. Rosenthal.
Exactly. Yes, I did. I've met a couple patients who are under the federal program. Wonderful, wonderful people. And it just amazes me that, you know, there's only a few selected people in our nation that are protected under federal law, and yet they can still say it's not for medicinal use. You know, there's no medicinal value to it.
I don't know. We're getting there, though. I honestly feel like the fact that now marijuana is legal in much of Canada, and that was last Friday that law was declared null and void, basically. And then Monday of this week, the federal government wants $1 billion to fight drug referendums in the United States. It's shows how desperate they are, I think.
Yeah, it's so sad.
Debbie, you know, you're not a hippie. You're not a pot smoker from way back.
Not at all. And, never have been.
Right. And, you know, as you said, you got to meet some of those federal patients, and you got to meet a lot of folks at the normal conference, a lot of long-time medical users, some recreational users, and just some,
a lot of normal people.
Normal people. You're right. Well, give me your impression. Was that the first conference you'd gone to?
It was the first conference. Gosh, I was just blown away by the support, and I don't know, everyone was just so nice, and it was such an eye-opening experience for both my mother and I.
Well, and I'm sure your mother, as I read the book, she's carried much of this load, has had to carry much of this load because you got so overburdened at times. Am I correct?
Absolutely. I can remember at times at night I would, call thinking I couldn't go on. You know, I could not go on with Jeffrey being so physically abusive and out of control. It was just, Mom helped come over, and I didn't live far from them, but my parents would come over just to help keep Jeffrey in control. It took more than just one person.
Right. Debbie, you are recently practically a newlywed here to your new husband, Bob. Do I have his name right?
Right.
And could I talk to him for just a moment?
Sure. Let me get him for you. One moment.
Okay. Oh, while Debbie's doing that, I'll just tell you that I think they've been married approximately 2 to 3 years. We'll get it from Bob. But, he's carrying part of this burden, too, and I'd like to just get his take.
Absolutely. Here he is.
Okay. Thank you, Debbie.
Howdy.
Hello, Bob.
Yeah.
Welcome to Cultural Baggage, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir. I was just talking to Debbie. This was when y'all first got together, I'm sure, made you think considerable about the situation, and yet you must love her quite dearly to have... picked it up, but I'm sure things are much better now. Could you tell us, how this situation impressed you when you first ran into it?
Well, when I first met Debbie, Jeff had some pretty severe problems, but it was right at the time when he was not quite on the marijuana, but started, and so it was a transition period there. And yeah, I knew the little guy had problems. There was no doubt about it. Two kids of my own from a previous marriage, so I'm familiar with raising kids. But Jeff, definitely a different situation. So, yeah, it was a moment to think it over. That's for sure.
Well, right.
But I also checked in with my kids too, because they're part of the family, and so we all agreed as a family to take on this situation, I guess you could call it. And so we just work at it from that perspective.
Right. I understand, Bob. You say you have a couple of older kids, and I know how that can be at times, a conflict, a time necessary. Kids want that attention.
Yeah, they do, and I try to divide up my time as best I can between everybody, But, they've had it a certain way for so long, and so there's been an adjustment for them as well, sure.
Yeah, and it's good that they are a bit older, then they can perhaps understand a little bit better. That,
You know, they're both teenagers now, so pretty much their world is wrapped up in their friends and all that sort of thing.
Well, sure, and that's great. I'm glad to hear that. Bob, we're going to go ahead and take just a little break here.
Okay.
I'm going to air some of the views from those. As I mentioned, I don't know if you got to hear when I was talking to Debbie, but we're going to hear from people whether or not this drug war is a continuing criminal enterprise. And first up, we're going to hear from Dr. Joe McNamara.
This is Joseph McNamara, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and the retired police chief of San Jose, California. Well, I spent more than 30 years in policing, starting in New York City on the East Coast. I was police chief for 3 years in the Midwest, Kansas City, Missouri, and then police chief for 15 years in San Jose, California, the third largest city in California. So that's the East Coast, Midwest, and the West Coast. And also, during that period of time, I took some leave and ended up with a doctorate from Harvard University, doing my dissertation on the history of criminalizing drugs in America and its impact on the police. And to sum it up, I think we made, as a nation, a tragic mistake in 1914 by adopting criminal prohibition of drugs. Immediately, we created a black market that yields vast profits to drug traffickers, to crooked police officers, lawyers, judges. We have damaged the integrity of our entire criminal justice system, correctional systems, and communities themselves in our neighborhoods. And we have not reduced the use of these so-called dangerous drugs. In fact, as everyone knows, the two most dangerous drugs, alcohol and tobacco, which are the most lethal, are not illegal at all. So the question is, what in the world are we doing with these punitive penalties that often hand out mandatory life sentences to people who are mules, as we call them in the jargon of the drug war, that they simply carry drugs. They're not big-time pushers or traffickers or running cartels. Those kind of people rarely get caught. And so this policy really needs to be looked at very closely and to be part of a national debate. Unfortunately, there's such an emotional reaction every time you mention drugs. People think you're advocating the use of these drugs when, in fact, what those of us involved in policing and studying public policy say, that's not what we're saying at all. We simply think that trying to apply the criminal justice legal system to what is essentially consensual transaction between individuals is doomed to failure. It's doomed to corruption. It's doomed to lead to a lot of violence and a lot of disrespect for law. And worst of all, it simply doesn't work. It does not reduce drug selling, drug production, and drug use.
That was Dr. Joe McNamara. I'd like to thank him for that. Just before we come back here, I want to make a couple of points. This is coming from the Drug Sense chat line. In regards to my question, is the U.S. drug policy a continuing criminal enterprise? Abe responds, the criminal enterprise is the prison industrial complex. And Herb has my next question. Who do we have online there? Is it Bob or Debbie?
Debbie.
Hi, Debbie. There's a question here came in from the Drug Sense chat line from Herb, and he's asking you, what does Jeff think of medical marijuana?
Jeffrey cried when he was not able to have his medical marijuana during those 3 months after the raid. He feels that it has saved his life. This is, you know, a nine-year-old talking, and, you know, he doesn't want it to ever have to go away. He thinks it's very unfair that, you know, the DEA would come in and take away his medicine that's allowed him the freedom to start living.
And this is very close to the second anniversary of the first time that he used the medical brownies, if I remember right.
Exactly. It's 2 years and 2 days since he first took his first dose of medical marijuana.
And life is much better, am I right?
Oh, my gosh.
No, the book says it all, and your smile, I can hear it in your voice, tells me things are much better.
10,000 times better. Jeffrey has life. He has been allowed to start living.
And right, he actually has friends that are willing to come to his birthday party because he's now able to control himself, right?
Yeah. Last Friday, in fact, it was the first time he's ever been able to participate in a school activity. It was an open house at school, and he and Daddy were out on the court, you know, doing this dance with all these other kids and parents. And it was just, I was standing there bawling. I was like, oh my gosh, this never would have happened before, ever.
Right. Oh, that's so wonderful, Debbie. I want to ask you something. You know, there are, I'm sure, thousands, if not tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people here in America that might benefit from this same medicine, or perhaps their own blend of medical marijuana. You provide links for people. What would you say to those people out there who may be thinking they have a similar situation in their family, especially in those states where there is legal marijuana available? What should you tell them?
The first thing I would tell them is educate yourself on medical marijuana and then go right to your doctor. You know, as the forward of our book of Jeffrey's journey, Dr. Peter Clark had said that to not allow this therapy is to deny yourself, you know, the possibilities of you know, help, therapeutic help. Get out there, and if you think that this could possibly help you, go for it, especially, you know, if it's legal in your state. You need to talk to your doctor and educate your doctor if he is against it. Or, you know, the reason why he's against it is because he doesn't know about the therapeutic values of medicinal marijuana. And go to safeaccess.org, WAMM.org, WAMM.org. Wonderful research there.
Yes, they... I understand you work some at the WAMM site, is that correct?
Yes, we are members. We're, you know, it's a collaborative. And we've been out on the farm, and you know, we are members of WAMM.
Yeah, I saw some of the video, you know, of the DEA agents with chainsaws cutting down these plants that were just days or weeks away from harvest.
Right.
And the outrage, you know, of these some people in wheelchairs or otherwise impaired spending hours and days making sure this medicine was healthy and organic and you know,
pure.
Sure, pure, the best they could. And these DEA agents came in and destroyed it. And I'm sure, you know, it was gut-wrenching. I heard that the one lady that was arrested and told to stand even though she needed crutches and they wanted to handcuff her, and it was a terrible situation, and it just shows the hypocrisy of what I guess the other side of my show I'm doing today about. I think it is a conspiracy. I think the pharmaceutical companies or somebody must be controlling this at the highest level.
Yeah, I agree.
Go ahead. But, Debbie, I look in here, you have these testimonials from, you know, some of Jeffrey's friends, his grandparents. You know, I'm sure people well respected in the community that have seen the validity and the truth and the effectiveness of medical marijuana.
That's right. That's right.
Tell us a little bit about your mother, Lorraine. She's, you know, had to endure this same, I don't know, agony, I guess, at one point. And yet you two have written this book. It's available from I'm trying to look at the publisher here. Where can people get a copy of this book?
You can get a copy at www.lorrainesplace.net, and that's spelled L A RayinEsplace, LorrainesPlace.net.
Okay. I do have another question that came in. This is more in regards to the legality of marijuana in Ontario. And I want to alert the listeners out there that you can please give us a call. Our number here is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. Debbie, when you had to deal with the bureaucracy, when they wanted to come after you as being, I don't know, I don't want to use it.
Unfit mother.
Unfit mother, yes. And because you were administering this medical marijuana, tell us how that story developed.
It was real interesting. In February, when Jeffrey failed residency, he was in a level 12 residential facility, and he failed residency. He needed a higher level of care. And I was always very forthright in letting them know about medical marijuana, and letting them know, meaning his mental health care workers, all the CPS workers, everyone that was on his case. And I got a thumbs up. They said, medical exploration, go ahead, you know, whatever helps. And they kind of laughed and giggled, you know. And it wasn't until a month and a half later, Jeffrey was on his medication. The results, I mean, were immediate, that he was doing wonderful. There was no dispute there. However, there was a doctor who, you know, was his mental health care doctor before the medical cannabis, who was his pharmaceutical, you know, prescribing pharmaceuticals, who turned us into CPS. And we got a phone call one day, and it was saying that we had to show up for court on the following Tuesday. And I'm like, for what? And they told us it was for, I had charges being alleged that I was an unfit mother because I was contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And we appeared before the court, and at that very first hearing, the judge, I had presented all the facts, you know, Jeffrey's entire records, medical history. The prosecuting team was kind of stunned and in awe, you know, but they still wanted Jeffrey off the medicine, off the marijuana. And the judge looked at all the evidence and said, it's a stay put. He stays on it until the case is over. So.
Well, here again, it's great to be in California. You have judges who are, at least on the state level, willing to consider benefit rather than, you know, persecution.
Absolutely.
I'm looking here at the some of the ads, not ads, the headlines that came out. Medical pot war engulfs boy 7. Mom says cannabis muffins aid his brain disorder. I don't know the rest of the story, how it developed. Were these stories presented with, you know, some insight?
The one, Wayne Wilson from the Sacramento Bee, who wrote the first two articles that came out, he did it in such a very classy way. Nothing talked down about us or anything, and he was very insightful, and he educated himself also on medical marijuana.
Well, that's good to know that you know, a reporter would actually do a little investigation. I like that. when you you know, look to the future, is this something that you know, you think will be long-term for Jeffrey?
It will be as long-term as it's going to be needed for Jeffrey. You know, who knows what the future holds, but I know what today holds.
Yes, and today's pretty good.
Today's great.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to take another little short break. I want to invite the callers to, you know, please give us a call, 713-526-5738.
This is Cliff Schaefer. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on KPFT Houston.
Homer, you're doing drugs. And now I'm guilty of possession. I could go to prison unless I testify against you.
Marge, it's making my eyes better. And it's legal. I could walk up to the president and blow smoke in his stupid monkey face, and he'd just have to sit there grooving on it.
Okay, we're going to hear now from Steve Nolan, and he's going to give us today's Activist Corner. Are you ready, Steve?
Oh, yeah. We got a couple of things coming up if people want to do something about what they've been hearing about. Coming up Tuesday on May 27th at noon, Americans for Safe Access are doing a call to action in response to the arrest of Gary and Anna Barrett. They're medical marijuana caregivers in California that had just recently been arrested. And Americans for Safe Access, they've been organizing these direct actions. So we're going to have more information about the federal building where we'll be at. So if y'all can make that out, show the government that they need to stop arresting medical marijuana patients. And also, just yesterday, the ONDCP reauthorization bill was postponed. For those that don't know, that was legislation that would use taxpayer money to help defeat pro-reform ballot measures and candidates. Well, they postponed the vote, but they'll be back in session on the week of June 2nd. So we'd like everyone to call their reps, you know, and let them know that they shouldn't be spending our money to defeat, you know, the people's will in pro-reform ballot measures. You can go to normal.org and put in your zip code, and that will bring up your reps. They have letters there, and you can add your own comments to it. Or you can also call the Capitol switchboard at 1-800-839-5276. That's 1-800-839-5276. And also coming up Tuesday on May 27th at midnight, our friends of Cop Watch will be having their show on KPFT. That starts at midnight on Tuesday and runs till 1 a.m. That's about it for Activist Corner. Back to you, Dean.
Thank you, Steve. We're going to take your calls here in just a minute. We do have some open lines still. Number 713-526-5738. Debbie, we're going to go ahead and take this call from Karen. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hi, Karen. Do you have a question for Miss Jeffries?
No, not a question. Just that I'm totally on everyone's side here. You know, marijuana has been used for in our society and all societies thousands of years, and only at the turn of this century did they suddenly, for no apparent reason, just do away with it and classify it as a drug instead of staying in medicine, when it's been for, you know, multiple decades prescribed for cataracts, nausea, as it's coming forward now with cancer treatments, arthritis, all of the medicinal purposes that it has and helps people, you know, and now they're talking about spending $1 billion in order to, you know, stop it, you know, its production or its progress in any way, is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard. And it's just, it shows part of the massive greed up at the top. And I'm just another one of your callers that it just makes sick. I'm just sick. It makes me sick. It just, I mean, especially when there's, you know, the it could stack a warehouse with evidence proving marijuana's never killed a person. It's never hurt a person, and its medical benefits pretty well outweigh any other one single type of medicine you could give to a person to alleviate so many big things, not headaches like Tylenol. I mean, you know, big things.
Well, sure, Karen, I think the whole point being, and Debbie, you jump in here whenever you want, is that, as we discussed, the blends, certain marijuanas affect pains, others affect, you know, nausea, and the government, through their draconian measures, prevent people from doing those in-depth studies and doing real scientific analysis.
Of course, and I believe that people up at the top have to be making money, and, you know, of course, without crime, we wouldn't have an economy, but, you know, that's taking it a little too far to me, because they can, you know, it's a medicine like any. You sell, you control, you gain taxes off of it. So it's a win-win situation for them, and you're only talking about marijuana. And right now we're talking about for medical reasons. We're not talking change the laws and let anybody and the hippies out on the street smoking pot if they want to and running rampant. I mean, it's just, it's so narrow-minded and so, it's just hard to comprehend.
It certainly is, Karen. I want to again alert the listeners out there. Please give us a call. 713-526-5738. Karen, one last thought. I wanted to just share with you. You say you're just an average listener out there. Have you seen instances? Do you know people who have benefited from medical marijuana?
Yes. I've had friends that were going through cancer treatment and couldn't get it medically. They bought it and smoked it anyway. And one in particular friend I'm thinking of had cancer of the bone in his leg and went through several years of radiation, chemotherapy. I mean, his vision, lost all his hair, his vision was being affected, the nausea, the in-depth pain, even with the pain medication they provided him. And he's, you know, would say, and this is if you want to talk about a pretty straight-laced guy, but it was like the relief that the marijuana gave him in all of those other areas, you know, he couldn't even express the relief that it provided for him, you know, in conjunction with the things he had to take, you know, to regain his health. But all of the side effects that some of those, you know, the cancer treatment brought on him, it alleviated most all of it.
I understand.
And the spectrum was, you know, 12 different things that, you know, helped to alleviate on him to make it through that treatment.
Karen, I want to thank you for your call. We appreciate it so much.
Yeah, thank you, Karen.
Thank you. Deb, I'm on your side, honey.
Thank you.
I wish the best for your son. God bless you.
Bless you.
Debbie, in dealing with WHAM, I'm sure you've met many other, you know, not just there at the conference, but many other medical patients. Can you describe some of the symptom alleviation you've seen with medical marijuana for those patients?
Gosh, you know, I have some very dear friends that I've, you know, some friendships that have been developed through this, and, you know, the dumping syndromes, not being able to eat at all, and this helps them. Pain. I have a friend who is on medical cannabis for pain who has had a leg ripped off. He was a police officer.
Mm.
And it's the only medication that helps him with pain and able to sleep. There's so many stories out there. It's just, you know, it's incredible to know what side effects, you know, pharmaceuticals have versus the side effects that marijuana has. And it's listed right there in the PDR, and it specifically states that no health hazards or side effects are known in conjunction with the proper administration of designated therapeutic doses of medical cannabis. It's just amazing.
Oh, it is, Debbie. To me, the most astounding, recognizable benefit that I've ever seen is people with MS that are, you know, very nervous, hard to talk, shaky voice, and that after a few talks in a minute or two are able to hold their hands out and you know, it just gives them so much more grace and a smile, you know, and it's hard to say that's not medicine.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this. You've often said that, within the book, you mentioned that it's almost impossible to find a unemployment situation where they can allow for, you know, the times, or it was that way, where for you to actually go and assist Jeff when situations would arise.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping your employment situation is better these days, and that the problems, you know, don't interfere with your work.
So far this year, in the last few months, I have new employment, and they seem to be very understanding and very compassionate towards Jeffrey and our situation. And so we just pray for the best.
Yes. Debbie, we're going to take just another little break here. But first, I wanted to again tell you, give us a call, 713-526. You can call in and give us your opinion. Is the U.S. drug policy a continuing criminal enterprise? I'd like to hear from you on that one. And we also want you to continue the discussion with Debbie Jeffries, author of Jeffries' Journey. And we'll be back in just a moment.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
This is Eric Sterling. I'm president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Washington. In the 1980s, I was counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary, principally responsible for anti-drug matters. When you look at the war on drugs and you say, how are we doing? Well, the war on drugs is a failure. Since 1979, the death rate from drugs has more than doubled, from 3.5 to over 7.0 per 100,000. In the last 12 years, hospital emergency room admissions for drugs has gone up 50%. In 1998, high school seniors said that heroin and marijuana were easier for them to get than at any time since we started asking them in 1975. We're not keeping drugs out of the hands of kids. We're not saving lives. And in fact, the traffickers are prospering. They're getting more efficient. It's easier and cheaper for them to deliver drugs to the United States. So the price of heroin and cocaine has gone down steadily in the last 20 years. The purity of heroin sold in the American street, the average purity has gone from 5% in 1980 to 25% in the year 2000. It's increased fivefold. The traffickers are winning. Now, here's a social policy that, on any kind of terms you say, is it doing what it's supposed to do, is failing. And we keep saying the war on drugs is a failure. Why does it continue? What purpose does it serve? The purpose is to maintain white privilege. When you look at the effect, you got a drug conviction, and only a drug conviction, you get kicked out of public housing. You got a drug conviction, get denied a loan to higher education. You got a drug conviction, you're denied for your lifetime welfare benefits under the TANF law. Get a drug conviction, you become less employable. Drug conviction, you can't get credit cards. Drug conviction, you can't get a mortgage. You can't buy a house in the country. That all of this, the war on drugs serves to, by racial profiling, means that blacks walking down the street, traveling on airplanes, driving on highways, riding the train, are stopped much more frequently in search for drugs than whites are. Yet the data shows that the police have a higher hit rate when they search whites than blacks. Why do law enforcement commanders allow an ineffective strategy to go forward? Because it serves to maintain white privilege. So when you look at what the war on drugs does, when you realize that even though blacks are about 15% of the drug users, they are 38% of those arrested for drugs. They're 58% of those convicted to drugs. The average black serves a year in prison longer than the average white. And you realize that 65% of all the blacks in federal prison are there on drug sentences. You realize that the war on drugs is not about protecting our kids from drugs, saving lives, fighting the drug traffickers, but it maintains white privilege in American society. That's why it's so hard to fight. That's why it's so evil and must be ended.
Again, that was Eric Sterling of the Criminal Policy Justice Center. We've got some callers online here, and I wanted to answer a question here. It was from Sonny Boy. You know, I'm no expert. I'm sorry, but your question was the fact that marijuana is now legal in Ontario and is being ignored by the American media. How long can they deny the reality? And my response, Sonny, is that we need to write LTEs that include reference to this. We need to expose it on our own because obviously they don't want the American people to know. I thank you for the question. Okay, let's go to Pat on line 2. Hello, Pat.
Yeah, it was basically my question, too, is what was legal? Is it just in Ontario? Is it medical? Is it recreational?
Oh, it's under 30 grams that is legal, basically, in Ontario in particular. I'm sure that the courts in the other provinces are having, you know, looking at it, determining if that's what they want to do at this time. But the way I understand it, it's you could actually drive by the police station smoking a joint in Ontario. There is no law at this point.
Basically like Amsterdam, almost.
Well, yeah, maybe even a little better. Though I hear that in Amsterdam they're beginning to look at legalizing, making it available through pharmacies and so forth.
Ah, okay. Well, that pretty much answers my question. I don't see why, you know, at first when they were talking about the legislature up there legalizing it, the U.S. was going to boycott Canadian products and stuff like that. They made a big deal about it. Now that it's happened, I guess they're trying to keep it under wraps.
Right. I think that's true enough. They just don't want the American people to know that, well, there's no whatever, an outbreak of mass murders going on in Canada.
Yeah. What is supposedly somebody that's been an ally all this time is now seeing the light. And they want to keep the dark going, I guess.
I think that's right, Pat. I appreciate the call.
All righty.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners. Debbie.
Yes?
Let's get back to your... let's get back to your book here for just a minute. I wanted to ask you, what's been the reaction of neighbors? I don't know, people you run into on the street. Do you get community support?
How do I say? Everyone who's known Jeffrey and has seen Jeffrey before his medical marijuana is so supportive. And when he was off his medication, the community, teachers, mental health care workers saw the difference in Jeffrey also, the horrible side effects of not having his medical cannabis available to him. So I would say that 99.9% of everybody that I've run into has been very supportive of Jeffrey being on medical cannabis.
Right. There was no... Well, I guess it was only the government that had that little glitch going where they got an unfit mother there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's just wonderful. Again, California is a wonderful place.
Yeah.
Debbie, what would you like to say to those people out there? You know, we just got a few minutes left that... you know, we talked about, you know, getting with the doctor and so forth, but... it was a big decision, wasn't it, to actually go ahead and use medical marijuana. If they come to that point, and perhaps the doctor agrees with it or even not, that if they're getting desperate, that they might consider it. How did you make that gut decision?
I had to weigh... I studied it. I really did. I studied all the medications Jeffrey had been on, all the side effects that, you know, there were to his liver, his kidneys. It wasn't a light decision. And the biggest decision I had to make was, I guess the biggest thing going for me is that it was legal here in California. And though in California it's a law, I have to stand by the fact that I'm a mom first, a Californian second, and an American third.
There you go. Yeah.
And I would go to the ends of the earth for my son. I've done everything I could. I educated myself on medicinal marijuana. I thought it could help. I went to the sources that could help me with possibly obtaining the medical marijuana for Jeffrey and the recommendation. They said that it wasn't going to harm him. Let's go forward. Let's see what it does. Again, you know, being in the PDR, it mentions it's been used in ancient years for mental illness, not knowing what it was going to do for Jeffrey, but we did know it wasn't going to hurt him. And within a half hour, the results were, you know, astonishing.
Yeah, I've been playing that little clip we did out there at the Hyatt, that where you said that he, mommy, my head doesn't hurt. It's not so noisy, is that right?
Yep, that's it.
And
it didn't have a traffic jam anymore.
I every day, you know, I do my 420 Drug War News, and I beg the listeners to consider doing a little something to educate their legislators, to because here in Texas, I mean, it's you know, very very different than California, of course.
Texas is near the Bible Belt, but that doesn't mean anything. There's a lot of Christians for cannabis now, and again, it's just educating. We're a conservative Christian family. We never thought my mom would be the pill packing granny, you know.
It's wonderful to see what a little education will do, you know, and we need to educate those legislators, don't we?
Absolutely. I did not vote for Prop 215 back in 1996. I didn't know. I thought it was, you know, it was just a proposition to pass for all the hippies and, you know.
Right.
And I was so wrong. I was so wrong. And I'm so glad that it passed here.
I understand, Debbie. Well, me too. I mean, when I go to California, I to these conferences in San Francisco, I get to meet the same patients year after year. And it's amazing during the day that some of these people that are confined to wheelchairs actually, after smoking cannabis, are able to kind of get up and walk their wheelchair around a little bit. And it's outrageous what the government's doing. Debbie, we have just a couple of minutes. I wanted you to please, once again, give the folks the website for getting a copy of your book.
Yes, it's Jeffrey's Journey is the book, and you can get it at www.lorainesplace.net, and that's LARAYNESPLACE.net.
Well, thank you. Debbie, I wanted to thank you and Bob,
and
Lorraine, and Jeff, and the other kids, you know.
Mark and Brittany.
Mark and Brittany, thank you, too. And it's wonderful to hear of a family that has so much hope and positive future going for them.
Well, thank you very much.
I want to, you know, think that perhaps in a year or two we can talk about this again as Jeffrey gets older, and someday we'll talk, hopefully when he's 18 or so, maybe we'll talk to him about his experience along the way.
That would be great.
Okay. Well, Debbie and Bob and all, thank you so much. And we're going to go ahead and pick up one more talking point here.
Great.
From another speaker about, you know, is the U.S. Drug war an ongoing criminal conspiracy?
Okay, Dean, thank you so much.
Thank you, Debbie, and good night.
Thank you.
The time is at hand. The drug warriors have no more ammunition of, you know, moral posturing or whatever. It's just ancient superstition they bandy about at this time.
Well, you're right. All we need to do is to legitimize the discussion. All we need to do is let people realize that it's okay to talk about drug policy. Just because we do so does not at all mean that we condone drug use or abuse. In fact, I hate these drugs so much, I want to change our system to reduce the harm that's going to be caused from them. Because as soon as people realize what's happening and they feel empowered enough to discuss it openly, I promise you they will absolutely want to stand up in unison, shake their fists and say, no, we've got to change this. We've got to repeal drug prohibition because of the all incredible benefits that will be accruing from that. And I was listening to you before I came on, and that every neutral study we've had in our country for the last 100 years has recommended the same thing. They have said, get away from the criminal justice system. Go to some form of decriminalization or regulation because of the incredible benefits that will accrue. Just like when we repealed alcohol prohibition. You know, crime went down nationwide. It plummeted after we repealed alcohol prohibition. It went down for about 11 straight years. And the same thing is going to happen when we finally repeal drug prohibition. Those are just things that we know will happen. We just have to get at it.
Yes, sir. I reached back a couple of months to the drug conference at Rice University, the Baker Institute, and I realized that, you know, of the approximate 100 people on a daily average that showed up, there would be one representative from the other side. They just don't have the ammunition. I know in reading your book, there have been many judges across America that have taken a stance, either refusing to try certain types of cases or speaking openly and publicly about ending this drug war. Have you run into any more of your associates that are now seeing the light?
Well, Dean, that's true. In fact, as you said, the subtitle of my book is Judicial Indictment of the War on Drugs. I quote something like 40 judges from around the country, in fact, some are from Texas, that say that what we're doing isn't working. They use their own experience and their thoughts as to what we should do instead. And since then, of course, what you're asking is really two questions. So what do judges tell me quietly and privately in the judges' lunchroom and the elevators? And almost all of them agree with me that what we're doing isn't working. Now, whether you're going to talk to them publicly about that.
Okay, that was Judge James P. Gray. We're running a little bit long here, and short, and I had to cut him off here. I want to tell you that next week we're going to have Chris Redd of Narconon. That's the fifth week, but I'm thinking that the other side will let me do this. And then in 2 weeks it will be the show The Other Side. But next week, fifth Friday, Cultural Baggage will be on again with Chris Redd of Narconon. And now here's my editorial to close out the show. With each passing day in America, democracy is dying. Mechanisms set in place by the drug war slowly steal our rights, our liberties, and our pursuit of happiness. Across this country, an estimated 10,000 prisoners are serving time for crimes they did not commit. The few who are able to prove their innocence often find themselves outside of prison with a handful of cash and a clean shirt as their only compensation. They are the dark secret of the U.S. justice system, the legal version of friendly fire that prosecutors only reluctantly acknowledge. Pseudo-government scientists with an axe to grind and a bank account to fill make sure that their scientific pronouncements prolong this drug war for the benefit of their fellow conspirators in law enforcement. The compassion of these drug warriors ensures that 240,000 inmates endure prison rapes every year here in America. A further lack of understanding ensures that those like the Tulia 13 still sit in prison 4.5 years after being convicted by the word of a highly discredited informer / paramilitary, one Tom Coleman. Despite the fact that government studies show that students who are forced to subject themselves to urine tests more often use hard drugs so as not to be discovered using marijuana, the one drug that has never killed a person in human history. And further, now that marijuana is legal in Canada, the U.S. Congress wants $1 billion to fight any referendum that would regulate marijuana here in the States. Great Britain is now pronouncing that drug prohibition is a failure. It assumes that the object of drug strategy would be to separate drugs from the users, but this fails to recognize that the result is to generate an ever-expanding black market which produces the deaths, illness, crime, and disorder, which is the strategy they hoped to reduce. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., the drug warriors continue their jihad against the American people. Their lack of compassion, their ignorance, and their unwillingness to understand the scientific data shows that the U.S. government, exceedingly more so than the Colombian drug cartels, is a continuing terrorist and criminal enterprise. For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, The Unvarnished Truth.